Imagine looking at a stopwatch. You click the button, the seconds start ticking, and before you even hit the minute and a half mark, a major abdominal surgery has gone from the very first skin incision all the way to the safe delivery of a baby.
Right, just 88 seconds.
88 seconds. I mean, it sounds physically impossible. Like you'd have to be moving with just reckless, chaotic speed in the operating room to achieve that kind of timeline.
It really does sound like a frantic rush, if you're picturing your standard surgical environment. But the reality of that 88-second delivery is, well, it's the absolute opposite of chaos. Yeah, it's the result of this stripped-down, highly evidence-based precision. It's what happens when a surgeon just removes every single unnecessary step, you know, every outdated tradition and every superfluous movement from the procedure.
So today we're doing a deep dive into how that level of efficiency is actually achieved. We're unpacking a really fascinating medical chapter authored by Professor Michael Stark, which is published in the Global Library of Women's Medicine.
Which is often referred to by the acronym GLOM, just for short.
Right, GLOM. And our mission today is to explore his blueprint for the most frequently performed abdominal operation on the planet, which is the cesarean delivery. We want to figure out how moving away from like rigid, tradition-based surgery can drastically improve a patient's recovery.
Because, I mean, if you or a partner have ever gone into a hospital for a major procedure, you probably just assume that the steps of that surgery have been standardized worldwide,
Oh,
right?
absolutely. You'd think it's based on the absolute best science everywhere.
Exactly. But despite being the most common abdominal surgery globally, a C-section isn't actually a single universally standardized procedure. Even today, it's more of a spectrum of varying methods based heavily on local hospital traditions.
And just the individual habits of whoever is holding the scalpel, which is wild to me.
Yeah, it really
Okay,
is.
let's unpack this because that detail from the chapter is so counterintuitive. You walk into a hospital and the way your body is treated might just depend on like where your surgeon happened to do their residency.
Or even what the senior doctor at that specific facility happened to prefer.
It's like trying to judge a worldwide baking competition. But every single baker is using a completely different recipe. How are you supposed to figure out why one cake flops and another one succeeds, you
You
know?
can't. And in medicine, we rely really heavily on something called benchmarking.
Right, to compare outcomes.
Yeah, comparing outcomes across different institutions to figure out what works best. But if one hospital uses a longitudinal incision, so up and down, and another uses a transverse side-to-side incision, and then one stitches the internal tissue while another leaves it open, you can't benchmark that data. It's like comparing apples to bicycles. You can't isolate the variables to see what's actually causing complications.
And the chapter provides this stunning historical example of just how stubborn that medical tradition can be, because until the early 20th century, a low longitudinal incision was the standard, right?
Yep, the up and down cut.
And then came the transverse Fanon style incision. This is the horizontal cut near the bikini line. And it looked much better cosmetically, but it required extensive internal tissue dissection to perform.
Which is a big deal for the body to recover from.
Exactly. And the timeline here is staggering. It took 71 years, 71 years after that transverse incision was introduced, before anyone actually conducted a comparative evaluation against the older one.
Yeah, 71 years of performing a highly invasive variation of a major surgery without any hard data proving it was actually safer for the mother or the baby.
That is just, I mean, that's terrifying.
It highlights a really dangerous reality in the operating room. Tradition often shapes surgical standards long before evidence ever gets a seat at the table. Surgeons just kept doing it because, well, that's how they were taught by their mentors.
But let me push back on the idea of a universal standard for a second. Shouldn't surgeons have the flexibility to tailor the surgery to the individual patient rather than following a rigid script? I mean,
Yeah.
everybody is different.
That's a great point, and Professor Michael Stark addresses that directly in the chapter. He clarifies that a universal method does not mean rigid uniformity. It's a baseline pathway for routine cases. Think of it as a foundation, not a straitjacket. It's simple enough to train medical residents on, but it has clearly defined adaptations built right into it.
Like what kind of adaptations?
So, if a patient has a poorly developed lower uterine segment, or maybe they've had multiple repeat deliveries, or there's obstructed access due to a large fibroid, the surgeon adapts. Having a standardized default for the 90% of routine cases actually frees up their mental bandwidth for the 10% that are complex.
So by stripping away the unnecessary variations in routine cases, you create a safer baseline.
Exactly.
And the core philosophy of Professor Michael Stark's baseline is just fascinating because it fundamentally challenges how we picture surgery. The whole blueprint basically comes down to do less cutting and do more separating.
Right, which starts before the first incision is even made. It goes right down to how the patient is positioned on the operating table. The preparation is meticulously planned to optimize the body's natural physiology.
So the patient is positioned supine on their back, but with a left lateral tilt.
Yes, and that's because of aortocaval compression.
Right, because the heavy, pregnant uterus can press down on the inferior vena cava, which is that massive vein returning blood to the heart. So tilting them slightly to the left shifts that weight off the blood vessel.
Which prevents the mother's blood pressure from suddenly dropping. They also utilize a mild Trendelenburg position.
What does that mean exactly?
It means the surgical bed is tilted so the patient's head is slightly lower than their pelvis. They're using gravity to their advantage.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that slight downward angle naturally shifts the bowels and the omentum, which is the fatty tissue covering the intestines towards the head. Mm-hmm. It moves those delicate organs safely out of the surgical field.
Giving the surgeon much clearer exposure. And they use a Foley catheter too, right?
Yes, to drain and decompress the bladder, it shrinks it down like a deflated balloon to keep it completely out of harm's way.
And even the surgeon's posture is mapped out here. The chapter notes that a right-handed surgeon should stand on the patient's right side.
Which is very intentional. It allows them to deliver the baby using their dominant hand, and later during the reconstruction phase, it ensures they can safely direct the suturing needle away from that deflated bladder we just mentioned.
It's all highly choreographed. But the entry itself, the incision, is where this really departs from what you see on TV medical dramas. They use an adapted Joel Cohen incision, a straight transverse cut about 2.5 centimeters below the hip bones. But they only cut through the very top layer of skin.
Right. They essentially just score the skin. The goal is to minimize unnecessary bleeding from all those tiny superficial vessels in the subcutaneous fat.
Okay, so then what?
After that initial score, they make a tiny, like 1 to 2 centimeter horizontal mick in the fascia. That's the tough fibrous layer encasing the abdominal muscles. And once that small nick is made, the scalpel is practically put away.
Wait, put away?
Yeah, they slide round-tipped, straight scissors under the fascia, but they don't even use them to cut. They just use them to gently open the space beneath the blood vessels.
See, this is the part that is so hard to wrap your head around as a layperson. We associate surgery with scalpel-sharp precision. We picture a doctor carefully slicing through every single layer. But this blueprint relies heavily on blunt tissue separation.
Yes, it does.
The surgeon literally inserts their index and middle fingers and pulls the tissue apart. Why on earth would a surgeon choose to, like, tear tissue with their fingers instead of neatly cutting it with a blade?
What's fascinating here is that the word blunt sounds aggressive, but in this context, it actually means gentle. Human tissue forms in distinct natural layers, very much like the pages of a thick book, and tiny blood vessels and nerves run between these layers. When you use a sharp scalpel, you're blindly slicing through everything in your path. You sever those bridging vessels, which causes bleeding, and then requires more time to stop that bleeding.
So by trying to be neat and precise with a scalpel, you're actually doing more damage to the underlying architecture of the abdomen.
Exactly. When you use your fingers to stretch and separate the tissue, specifically using bidigital stretching, the tissue yields naturally along the paths of least resistance.
It just separates.
Right. It separates along those natural planes without severing the blood vessels that bridge them. When you stretch the peritoneum, the thin membrane lining the cavity instead of cutting it, you significantly reduce the risk of inadvertently snipping nearby structures like the bowel. You preserve vascular integrity.
So blunter is better. I mean, when you picture those natural layers just sliding apart intact, it completely changes how you view the operation. And because they haven't spent time meticulously slicing and clamping dozens of tiny blood vessels, they reach the uterus incredibly fast.
Very fast. But before they open the uterus, they have to navigate the bladder. They incise the vesicuterine peritoneal fold, which is this thin reflection of tissue between the bladder and the uterus. They gently push that decompressed bladder downward out of the danger zone.
And then they make a transverse incision in the lower uterine segment. And the chapter points out that the location of this cut is highly deliberate, right?
Yes, because the lower segment of the uterus is composed mostly of fibrous tissue. It has far fewer contractile muscle fibers than the upper body of the uterus.
Which means it heals better.
Exactly. Making the cut down there means the resulting scar will heal stronger, making it much better equipped to withstand the intense mechanical pressure of any future pregnancies.
Okay, so once that small transverse cut is made, they stretch it bluntly, just like the abdominal layers. A flat Doyen retractor is inserted to hold the tissue back, protecting the bladder. And then the surgeon uses their dominant hand to guide the baby out, while an assistant applies gentle, targeted pressure to the top of the uterus, the fundus.
Pushing downward along the fetal axis, yeah.
Which brings us back to that 88-second statistic from the beginning. The chapter references a documented video where the time from the very first stroke of the scalpel to the complete delivery of the baby was 88 seconds. And this was in a patient with a body mass index of 38.
Right. It wasn't some idealized, easy scenario. And that speed is absolutely vital during an emergency like fetal distress, when a baby is deprived of oxygen. Cutting the delivery time down to under 2 minutes is literally the difference between a tragedy and a healthy newborn.
It's incredible. But, you know, my instinct as a bystander watching this hyper-efficient delivery would be to keep that momentum going. Like, once the baby is out, I'd want to rush and get everything else out immediately. Get the placenta out, close the patient up. Why do they intentionally slow down and wait for the placenta?
Because true efficiency is about respecting human physiology, not just rushing the clock. The clinical evidence strongly dictates that the placenta should be allowed to separate spontaneously from the uterine wall.
The body just knows how to detach it.
Exactly. If it doesn't detach on its own, the surgeon uses gentle, controlled cord traction. But manual removal, where the surgeon reaches in and physically scrapes it away, actively causes harm.
It introduces trauma to the uterine lining, right? Which increases blood loss and significantly raises the risk of endometritis, which is a severe postoperative infection.
Right. The overarching philosophy of this blueprint is that physiological processes should be respected unless clinical circumstances force your hand. Rushing manual removal when you don't need to means you're substituting a natural, safe process with an artificial, traumatic one.
And that philosophy of letting the body do its thing leads us right into the reconstruction phase, the closure. Here's where it gets really interesting, because this part of Professor Michael Stark's chapter challenges everything surgeons were taught for generations about how to safely close up a patient.
It really does. So let's start with the uterus. After they've ensured all bleeding is controlled, they close that lower uterine incision with a single layer locked continuous suture.
And they use a massive needle to do it. An 80-millimeter semicircle round-bodied needle. Why so big?
There's a very specific mechanical reason. A larger needle means the surgeon takes fewer bites through the tissue to close the incision. And fewer bites mean significantly less physical suture material is left behind in the uterine wall. You have to remember, suture material is a foreign object. The immune system recognizes it as an invader. So the less foreign material you leave behind, the less inflammatory foreign body reaction the patient experiences during recovery.
Makes total sense. And they also completely abandon a longstanding practice called routine towel packing. Historically, surgeons would pack the abdominal cavity with surgical towels to keep the intestines out of the way. But it turns out just the mechanical abrasion of those cotton towels rubbing against delicate internal organs damages them.
Yeah, it damages the outer cellular layer. That abrasion causes the body to deposit fibrin, a protein involved in blood clotting. As that heals, it causes postoperative adhesions where the tissues scar and essentially glue themselves together.
Which is incredibly painful.
Very painful. And it makes any future surgeries really dangerous. So by simply not putting towels in the abdomen, they eliminate a massive source of future suffering.
But the biggest shock for many traditional surgeons is how this blueprint handles the peritoneum.
Oh, yeah.
You have two layers of this membrane, right? The visceral layer that covers the organs and the parietal layer that lines the abdominal wall. Historically, surgeons spent significant time meticulously stitching both of these layers back together. But under this blueprint, both of those peritoneal layers are left completely unclosed.
Not a single stitch.
Wait, leaving an internal layer completely open? That goes against everything we assume about closing a patient up safely. It feels like leaving the front door wide open.
It feels incredibly counterintuitive, I know. But the experimental observations and clinical data on this are overwhelmingly clear. The peritoneum is a highly resilient membrane, and it doesn't heal like your skin does.
How does it heal then?
Well, if you cut your arm, the skin heals from the edges inward. But the peritoneum heals simultaneously across the entire surface through a process called mesothelial regeneration. New cells just slide over the gap and repair perfectly in 1 or 2 days.
It's like supergluing a scraped knee instead of letting a scab form naturally. If you stitch the peritoneum up, you're pulling tissue tightly together. And that tension restricts blood flow to the area, which causes ischemia.
Furthermore, you're introducing more of that foreign suture material we talked about, which triggers an inflammatory immune response. So by trying to fix the tear, you're actively creating a localized area of restricted blood flow and inflammation.
And the result of that combination is painful adhesions. The body just scars over the stitches. By doing less, by simply leaving the layers open, the surgeon is enabling the body to heal faster.
Right. They do close the strong fascial layer, of course, because that's what maintains the structural integrity of the abdominal wall. But then, when they get to the skin, they skip yet another traditional step. They don't perform routine separate stitches for the subcutaneous fat layer.
Instead, they use a few widely spaced Donati sutures for the skin. These specific stitches dip down to catch that subcutaneous layer at the same time, bringing the edges together without sealing the space completely tight.
Which allows any early post-operative fluid, like serum or minor bleeding, to just drain out naturally between the stitches. If you tightly stitch that fat layer closed, that fluid has nowhere to go. It pools under the skin, creating a hematoma or a seroma, which can easily become infected.
The entire sequence is just an exercise in minimizing foreign intervention. And because the surgical trauma is so vastly reduced, it completely changes what happens after the patient leaves the OR. It reminds me of a pit stop in Formula One racing.
That's a great analogy.
Right. Because the race isn't over when the car leaves the box. The recovery is completely integrated into the strategy.
Exactly. Because the tissue trauma is minimized, no severed abdominal muscles, no tightly stitched peritoneum restricting movement, the patient experiences significantly less pain. This allows the hospital to implement and enhance a recovery protocol. The very first element of that is early ambulation. They get the patient out of bed and walking as soon as safely possible.
Which is critical for preventing those dangerous blood clots, venous thromboembolism that can form in the legs when a patient is stationary.
They also encourage early oral hydration and feeding. For decades, patients were starved after abdominal surgery under the assumption that the digestive tract needed to rest.
But there's no evidence for that, right?
None for uncomplicated cases. Eating early actually helps jumpstart normal bowel function. They also manage post-op pain with multimodal analgesia, prioritizing non-opioid medications like ibuprofen and acetaminophen to avoid the sedating and constipating side effects of opioids.
Which brings us to a brilliant low-tech detail from the chapter, chewing gum. They actually give the recovering patient chewing gum to stimulate bowel motility.
It's a neurological trick called sham feeding. The physical act of chewing sends a signal down the vagus nerve to the brain, essentially saying, hey, food is coming. The brain then signals the intestines to wake up and start their muscular contractions, peristalsis.
So it prevents the bowels from freezing up after surgery. It's a wonderfully simple, inexpensive solution. Mm. And because of all this, the blunt separation, the unclosed layers, the chewing gum patients can often be discharged in just 2 to 3 days.
It's a complete paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been rigorously validated. Professor Michael Stark presented this blueprint at the FIGO World Congress in Montreal back in 1995. It generated such massive interest that surgeons traveled to Jerusalem just to observe the technique. Then in 1999, a major comparative study in Uppsala, Sweden, provided the definitive hard data validating it. Today, it's used in over 100 countries.
So what does this all mean for the listener? Beyond the fascinating mechanics of an 88-second delivery, why is this chapter a public health priority?
Because C-section rates are rising globally. It's an unavoidable reality. And because the volume is so high, the variability in how they're performed leads to inconsistent outcomes. Reliance on outdated traditions leads to increased costs, longer hospital stays, and entirely preventable morbidity for mothers. This chapter is a direct call for health ministries worldwide to officially endorse a unified, evidence-based standard of care.
It's about taking decades of proven evidence and translating it into action so that no matter what hospital a mother walks into, she gets the safest, least traumatic care possible.
Standardization based on physiology rather than habit strips away the ego of the individual surgeon and places the natural healing capacity of the patient at the center.
We have covered incredible ground today. By exploring Professor Michael Stark's chapter in GLOAM, we've seen how having the courage to discard long-held traditions can revolutionize medicine. Simplifying a process can radically enhance human safety.
It's a powerful reminder that sometimes the best medical intervention is knowing when to step back and let the body do its work.
And that leaves us with a fascinating final thought for you to take away. We've seen how medical tradition caused highly educated surgeons to unnecessarily stitch up internal tissues for 71 yims, causing painful adhesions, simply because that's how it's always been done. So looking at your own life, what other deeply ingrained practices, whether in your workplace, your relationships, or your daily habits, are you blindly repeating right now that might actually be causing more harm than good? Are you meticulously stitching up a problem that would heal much better if you just left it alone?
That is certainly a question worth asking.
Until next time, keep questioning the traditions and keep digging deeper.